coming. And I would like to extend a very warm welcome to Dr. Cahill and his son, Sean, and thank them for making the pilgrimage all the way from Manhattan to Fairfield, Iowa. The poet Yeats said, "In dreams begin responsibilities." And in his new book, A Dream for Dublin, Dr. Kevin Cahill outlines a dream that kept him up on a cold, damp, and lonely night in Dublin in 1960, a dream that indeed led to decades of responsibilities. Spending the night in a bed and breakfast that was, in his own words, blessedly inexpensive, where to get even a few moments of heat, you had to put a coin into the heater. And fresh from his work in India, he mapped out a plan for a new Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. Dr. Cahill said that the dream developed that night into a fully formed tree with flowering branches, and it became a reality as the new department came to life under his attentive guidance and care, even all the while maintaining full medical responsibilities in New York. The end result was that 4,000 medical doctors from countries on every continent were trained, highly trained, to treat and cure diseases that cause some of the world's most persistent suffering. There is an old saying that when a tree bears many fruits, their collective weight causes the tree to bow low, and like that, a person with many real and significant accomplishments also bows in humility. And because Dr. Cahill has that humility, he did not want me to talk much about him tonight, but I wanted to steal a phrase from one of your books, title of one of your books. It's our delight tonight to bear witness and to celebrate a few of Dr. Cahill's many wonderful qualities which have blossomed so fully in a lifetime of achievements coming to the aid of his fellow man. His lifelong opposition to violence as a solution to conflict has required him on many occasions to be the lone voice pointing to new pathways to peace. Born in New York to Irish immigrant parents, his father was a physician, and in his earliest days as a medical doctor in the U.S. Navy, he began to conduct relief work in some of the world's most troubled places. He has traveled to 70 countries, probably over 70 countries, to provide care to those most in need. And he says now that his proudest achievement is a program he created at Fordham University that offers an international diploma in humanitarian assistance, both undergraduate and master's degrees. And this filled a great need to offer standardized, systematic, and academically sound training for relief workers globally. And that program, like the one he formed for doctors at the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine in Ireland, has thousands of graduates from 133 countries. Its impact on improving the quality of relief work is incalculable. Throughout his career, he has held positions of great administrative responsibility as, for example, chairman of the Health and Planning Commission of the State of New York, where he had a budget of $7 billion and 80,000 people who reported to him. But you would never know that when you're an actual patient in his office. And no matter whether Dr. Cahill is treating popes or presidents or enormously famous movie stars or villagers in South Sudan or Somalia, every single person he sees is touched by the same simple, genuine, personal, and quietly authoritative care and kindness. And I always feel this when I walk into your office and cross the threshold on Fifth Avenue there, Central Park, across from Central Park, that I find that I'm stepping into another time. It's a kind of a magical world, a world of wisdom, philosophy, poetry, and above all, compassion. And it is because of Dr. Cahill's deep compassion and his lifelong desire and practical work to alleviate suffering, wherever he has found it in the world, that we are presenting him tonight with the Marshy Award for Health and Humanitarianism. And Dr. Cahill, I'm sure that many of the people that you see here in this room are teachers that you brought back to good health after their travels to many of those places. And it's now a joy to ask Dr. Keith Wallace, Marshy University's first president, member of the Board of Trustees. Marshy called him the first scientist of the Age of Enlightenment for his groundbreaking research. And Dr. Wallace will present you with the Marshy Award. And afterwards, we'd like to ask you to share some of the wisdom that you've gathered over all these decades of traveling the world, bringing the gift of health, the light of knowledge, and the eternal hope and optimism that you always feel inside your heart.
So I think for all of us here who have been very devoted to helping create perfect health and peace in the world, here is a man who really has lived those ideals that we stand for, who has spent his entire life really as almost a devotional act in terms of taking care of the world and creating pathways where there were no pathways, creating opportunities where there were no opportunities. And really, you'd have to say, you know, with great sacrifice, providing the knowledge and wisdom he has to people all over the world. So I think it's very easy for all of us to appreciate that because our lives have been very focused on those same ideals from Maharishi, and we feel very appreciative of a man like Dr. Cahill, who, despite all of his incredible awards we're not supposed to talk about, his 50 books that he's co-authored, and his 27 honorary degrees, and long list of awards and achievements, is such a humble and very sweet man, and a man who exemplifies everything that this university stands for. So I think it's a tremendous opportunity for this university to be able to, in some very, very small and humble way, thank you for what you've done around the world and really appreciate an individual with such integrity and such really service to humanity. Thank you so much, Dr. K.
Before I begin, I'd just like to acknowledge all the kind words, but also my request that there not be too many kind words, which completely Mike and Dr. Wallace didn't honor. I wrote these words in your honor, and it is a great honor indeed to be welcomed to this university and this community. These are not the standard words of a guest speaker, but are from one who has been privileged over many decades to serve the medical needs of the Maharishi family and faculty, as they often fell ill in India and then returned to Fairfield, Iowa, with a stop in my office in New York for diagnosis and therapy. This evening, I would like to focus on the role of a university in defining a new discipline, in incorporating ancient and noble ideals and practices into a recognized curriculum. You have done this with the teaching of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi by translating his search for inner wisdom through transcendental meditation into academic courses. Over a lifetime, I have tried to distill experiences on the front lines of humanitarian crises, whether due to natural disasters or as the inevitable side effects of armed conflicts, into acceptable university programs to change the perception of humanitarian relief from merely the action of do-gooders into a distinct new profession, and to use this legitimacy to build bridges to peace and understanding in times of war. My own introduction to tropical medicine and to the interrelationships of poverty and disease occurred in India, an experience that links me with many in this audience. I began work in Calcutta in 1959 and fell in love with a way of life. I found romance in settings that others might see only as dirty, broken down wastelands. Surely those negatives existed in Calcutta. But amidst the fetid stenches of Indian urban decay, I could close my eyes and see saffron robes rather than soiled rags. I could hear music in the cacophonous sounds of the slums and in the long silence of a city drenched in the humid heat that comes with monsoon rains. Starting early in the 1960s, the complex demands posed by the chaos of refugee camps inevitably became part of my duties as a physician working in troubled areas of Somalia, Sudan, and Central America. By the 1970s, after the Sahel drought, I managed camps handling over 1 million refugees and internally displaced persons in Somalia. This responsibility brought new logistical, legal, political, diplomatic, and most importantly, moral dilemmas that superseded the purely clinical and public health practice I had previously accepted as my professional role. No longer would the emphasis be solely on the life cycle of parasites and the detection of specific diseases, or on therapy, or even on the prevention of illnesses. I had become involved in a profound cultural drama between the developed and the developing worlds, in new struggles and philosophic and programmatic efforts to promote peace and justice in an unfair world. Physicians are accustomed to offer diagnoses and treatments usually based on scientific analyses and on clinical measurements supported by various laboratory, radiographic, and numerous other technical tests and procedures. Modern Western-trained medical personnel rarely alter their therapeutic recommendations to accommodate cultural factors. But in international disaster relief operations, particularly in complex humanitarian crises, many other forces are of paramount concern. In conflict zones, the physician deals not only with the physical effects of trauma, but also with dark and tangled roots of hatred and the incipient revenge that blossom in such unrelenting misery. Yet with patience and respect for others' human dignity, by balancing passion and compassion, by practicing civility and trying to understand the bases for hostility in those we assist, one can learn many lessons, particularly from the dispossessed and oppressed, and develop a special approach to life. In the midst of such harsh reality, however, one can find great beauty. My wife used to say that I was the only person she knew who could come home after 3 months in a Somali refugee camp and keep her awake all night describing in great detail how lovely so many parts of the experience were. Obviously, there were incredible scenes of sadness and evil, but there were also exquisite sunrises and sunsets in the desert, and the magical sounds of children laughing, and the incredible strength of mothers and grandmothers coping in a daily struggle to survive. Much depends on the mind's eye, how the mind's eye sees and interprets the fields in which we labor. Those who have worked on the front lines of disaster relief must clearly address the problems of an increasingly dysfunctional world. There are many cruel facets in the humanitarian struggle, and no amount of diplomatic sophistry can dehumanize the horrors of conflict and the waste of human lives. They are human beings, not dull statistics, who suffer and die in such situations. In the sad settings of refugee camps, mothers and children are the disposable refuse of global insecurity. Becoming a child soldier or a sex slave are terrible, realistic options for youngsters. One quickly became aware that there are no simple answers in such situations. Solutions, when they could be constructed, drew on many, many disciplines. It was essential to extend the professional standards that prevailed in tropical medicine to the less organized field of humanitarian affairs. Disaster management is an evolving science, but it is at times of great calamity and suffering where the developed and the developing worlds most intimately interact. These occasions, if mismanaged, cause further divisions in an ever more polarized world between the haves and the have-nots. But if managed correctly, with forethought and planning, with sensitivity and clinical efficiency, something profoundly good can emerge. There may be no more important arena in which academic standards needed to be urgently applied than in the repetitive humanitarian crises that shame our so-called civilization. When I was young and very innocent, I thought I was inordinately important as a medical doctor in a refugee camp. But it did not take long to realize, with growing humility, that those in charge of water, or food, or shelter, or security, or sanitation, or education, were essential partners. Everyone in a field operation soon appreciates that no one can accomplish very much working alone. If there is to be any progress in restoring a semblance of stability for those who have lost almost everything, we had to overcome our own restrictive professional barriers. Experiences often ran counter to the established didactic methods so easily accepted as doctrine in a Western medical school. As but one important example in delivering humanitarian assistance, one must learn to approach those in pain in a non-judgmental manner. Relief workers must leave behind their pride, their preoccupations, and sublimate their own interests and agendas in an act of solidarity with refugees and displaced persons. They must learn to tread softly, to offer change with great care. Existing customs and practice in any community, especially in the chaos of refugee camps, must not be altered without consultation and deliberation. The ways of a people, sometimes quite incomprehensible to a person trained in a Western scientific system, are ultimately that group's own precious heritage and protection. Attempts to introduce new methods and replace time-worn approaches can be devastating at times of crisis, when the utter failure of society makes people extremely vulnerable while simultaneously forcing them to be completely dependent on strangers for the essentials of life. For over a half century, I have been privileged to work in remote areas among people far removed from the effects, good and bad, of modernity. The more I participated in the daily lives of isolated clans, the more convinced I became that the richness of humanity lay in its incredible diversity. I do not share the belief that there is only one right way, whether that is how to rule or how to worship or court a mate or establish a family or express love or even how to die. Any diminution in that diversity diminishes all of us. Attempts to homogenize the world, to impose uniform standards of behavior, to stifle differences of opinion and style, to impose restrictions on customs and practices merely because they are different from our own are regressive, usually destructive acts. The biological world thrives in its complexity, and artistic creativity flourishes best when there are multiple varying stimuli. There had been no courses, except possibly in philosophy or anthropology or comparative literature at the college level, that prepared me for the almost bizarre demands I immediately faced in attempting to establish and manage CAMHS for many thousands of frightened, ill, and endangered people. There were certainly no courses in the standard medical school curriculum that were very helpful. A few examples may demonstrate different challenges that expanded my traditional role as a physician in crisis areas. First, early in my career, I found myself in South Sudan, responsible not only for health concerns, but also for providing other basic human services, including security. It certainly was of little help to a young girl to tell her that her malaria was cured if she was raped every time she went foraging for firewood. Another example, in 1972, an earthquake destroyed the center of Managua, Nicaragua. I served as chief medical advisor, sharing a tent with the then president for 6 weeks. There I learned how politics and corruption can pollute so-called relief missions. A significant percentage of the international aid was openly looted by the president's cronies, and the donors did not complain for, quote, end quote, diplomatic reasons. I sadly learned the limitations of altruism in the face of evil. But there were also diplomatic possibilities in our humanitarian work, and these could and surely needed to be exploited. Public health offered an almost ideal platform for preventive diplomacy. Almost 50 years ago, in the midst of a raging civil war in South Sudan, we established corridors of tranquility, as we called them, to allow emergency relief. These were, to all combatants, de facto ceasefire zones. They became temporary bridges to understanding and peace. That peace didn't last. But the effectiveness of those corridors is still recalled today by those who struggle to find that elusive common ground in the blood-soaked soil of South Sudan. One must constantly devise imaginative and innovative paths forward. Managing complex humanitarian emergencies, particularly in the middle of conflicts and disasters, is not a field for amateurs. Good intentions are a common but tragically inadequate substitute for well-planned, efficiently coordinated, and carefully implemented operations that must have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Compassion and charity are only elements in humanitarian assistance programs. Alone, they are self-indulgent emotions that may satisfy the donor for a short time, but will always fail to help victims in dire straits. When I first began working in complex humanitarian crises, there were almost no accepted standards. In fact, there was not even a common vocabulary. What was desperately needed was the creation of a new profession, one that could embrace the many areas of expertise required to provide an overall response. And this is where academia had to enter the picture. And I go to the university. It is primarily in the university where knowledge is analyzed and defined, where good and bad practices are studied, where the lessons of the past are examined in a continuing search for wisdom and understanding. Humanitarian assistance is an ideal area for academic interest. It presents a multidisciplinary challenge, drawing upon others, the fields of public health and medicine, law and politics, logistics and security, technology and anthropology, indeed all the social, physical, moral, economic, and philosophic arts and sciences. Society has entrusted universities with establishing rigorous standards to assure good practices. In almost any nation, for example, One must pass an academic exam to practice as a doctor or a lawyer. In the United States, one must qualify by government testing to be a plumber or a hairdresser. Yet there were no standards required to become a humanitarian worker. One only had to have, or contend to have, a big heart and lots of compassion. I sadly discovered as a physician working in refugee camps that a not insignificant percentage of humanitarian workers were primarily there to fulfill their own needs, to gratify their own dreams, to satisfy a distorted sense of redemption in a place of chaos. Many had no training, few skills, and even fewer resources to sustain them. These deluded volunteers complicated relief efforts, often causing more harm than good, and an inordinate amount of time was spent helping to extricate self-anointed humanitarian workers from refugee camps, draining vital energies that should have been devoted to the real victims of the disaster. Such experiences led me to the university to establish consistent requirements for appropriate training for all, whatever their other skills, who presume to enter turbulent areas of disaster and share in the inordinately satisfying task of dispensing critical assistance. Over the past few decades, there has been a slow but steady progress in developing formal university courses in humanitarian action. As mentioned, at Fordham University, through its Institute of International Humanitarian Affairs, we now offer an undergraduate major, one of only four in the world, as well as graduate level master's degrees in this discipline. The university should be, and usually is, the last bastion where open discussions and respect for differing ideals prevail. It is society's ultimate refuge from bias and prejudice, and these are among the most significant causative factors in humanitarian crises. The search for answers in such crises cannot be limited to a medical school or a law school or any other specialized school. It involves all the many interlinking fields of study that are the foundation of a true university. The former president of Fordham University, Father Joseph O'Hare, once defined our institution as a place where tradition is not only recovered and remembered, but also renewed and transformed. In its classrooms, libraries, and laboratories, the wisdom of the past should confront each day the questions of tomorrow. In the life of the ideal university community, new questions are not feared and suppressed, but welcomed and debated. In actual life, of course, university communities do not always resist the narrow politicization of advocates that declare what is and what is not acceptable thinking. In the wake of the September 11th terrorist attack and the continuing violence in the Middle East, debate over the fundamental causes of the conflicts often became polarized and the legitimacy of dissident scholars challenged because of their political views. If the university is to fulfill its historic role as a forum for competing views, we must insist on the essential conditions for civil debate, and those are mutual respect and honest recognition of differences. Civility does not compromise moral commitment, although this is not obvious to campus activists who find demonstrations more satisfying than debates. Michael Bush, who introduced me, the Maharishi University Director of International Projects, asked that I conclude with some very personal tales and reflections. I have been caught behind the lines in armed conflicts and seen senseless slaughter from the Middle East to Managua and all across the scarred landscape of modern Africa. Somehow, in the twisted wreckage of war, and in the squalor of refugee camps, the incredible beauty of humanity prevailed for me, as it does for most of those who work in humanitarian assistance. I learned that prejudice and economic exploitation, pride and politics, racism and religion, weather and witchcraft, corruption and incompetence were all integral parts of the problems I had to address. It was essential to hear and appreciate the cry of the oppressed and the burden of ignorance, fear, and poverty if one was to provide help in developing lands, especially during and after periods of disaster. A very important lesson from my first period in Calcutta was I had to stay calm and focused in the midst of chaos if I wanted to help others. There was no time for self-indulgent personal concerns. The petty needs that so often dominate our lives distract us from getting critical tasks accomplished. I realized, often with embarrassment, that our own individual cares simply did not matter much in the face of what others were suffering every day, all day, in the disaster that life offered them. It was my fortune to serve and even to begin to identify with those caught in the crossfire of conflicts not of their own making. A spiritual solidarity develops in just being with them. They were my brothers and sisters. I have always returned, although part of me never returned, from refugee camps, gratified to be allowed to participate in their valiant efforts. I have helped, even healed, many desperate victims in humanitarian crises, but they in turn helped, healed, instructed, and enriched me. It is that perspective that sustains us on what otherwise may seem like a journey through hell on earth. It takes time to refocus the romance of youth into reflective, lasting programs in humanitarian crises, to change the passion of love into healing projects. It would certainly have been easier and safer to reap the rewards assured by a predictable medical practice at home. However, that was not what fate offered. My wife and I discovered a new world and ourselves in politically volatile areas where change and revolution were in the air and on the streets. A career in tropical medicine allowed unusual access into closed, often hostile societies. I was able to share in the dreams and aspirations of men and women in the developing world who were fighting for freedom, equality, basic human rights, and often for their very survival. And on that note, I would like to close by identifying with so many here tonight who have devoted their lives in a parallel path toward healing by assuring that the teachings of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi have become part of the academic programs, thereby building bridges to peace as strong as those I have attempted to do with humanitarian efforts. A bridge is a blend of poetry and practicality. By harnessing tensions and forces, we can span abysses, link separated lands, and create a structure of beauty. But soaring girders and graceful arches must be firmly anchored in a solid foundation, lest a load of unplanned aspirations cause a collapse, destroying both the bridge and the travelers on the journey of life. Thank you very much. I was just asked by the first president of the university would I like to take questions. So now that my speech is over, or observations, they don't have to be questions. Anyone have anything they'd like to offer?
Thank you for your speech. I have two questions. Oh, sorry. It's possible in your perspective to introduce in all university TM, so Transcendental Meditation, as a humanitarian course to respond to the humanitarian crisis? That's my first question.
Is it possible to introduce a course?
TM as a course in all university.
I don't know enough about TM, so I can't answer the question.
Okay.
I'm learning, though. I had a very full day under Michael Bush's instruction, so I've met lots of people today.
Another question I propose to you, Doctor, is to incorporate Transcendental Meditation in social medicine to reduce the suffering in our society.
Well, what I heard today was that it's already being done in many countries around the world, but you'd get a better answer from the authorities in this university than you would from me.
Thank you, Doctor.
Anyone else would like to say anything? Yes, Doctor.
Great speech. Thank you, sir. Thanks for coming. My daughter has visited you twice. She's from Cincinnati, and she had caught some worms, and I think she visited you twice. But I was wondering, did you want to go into tropical medicine, or was it a byproduct of your spending time in Calcutta and Sudan and all those places?
I think like most of life, these are a series of accidents. And I probably went into it partially because of my own Irish family background and a certain rebelliousness. My father was a physician, but I first ended up in Calcutta and I had this wonderful experience of seeing diseases that I never thought I'd ever see, and in numbers I never thought I'd ever. And then as I told Michael and Peggy, I was drafted and I was sent in the Navy to Africa and the Middle East, and I was in a research unit. And by the time I came home 4 years later, I had written a lot of research papers and a textbook that's still in press. So I think those series of accidents are what get you to where you do. I've had a wonderful life. My wife died 12 years ago, but before she died, or after she died, I figured I had worked at that time and, as Mike said, close to 70 countries, but she had come to 45, never in conflicts, but she'd go back on revisits with me, and my children, you know, came to Somalia and Nicaragua, so it's been a wonderful life. Anyway, I don't know how, that's a very personal answer, yes.
I'm so happy to have been here tonight to hear you speak. It was just so impressive and so wonderful. But I also noted that there are many of the older generation here, and I think because it's block break, many students today, you know, they enjoy their holidays. And I was thinking, would it be possible that you would return many times and really speak in class, in the blocks, directly to the students, because it's so much needed. So I speak as a student too, and I think it would be so valuable, and it's so important to train the young generation, yeah, and give that wisdom and that experience that you have to them.
Well, I'm touched by the idea, but as but as Michael said, it's a bit of a pilgrimage to get here, and I'm still seeing patients every day, and I'm running a large operation in New York. But, you know, we have already begun to think of ways in which we might have mutual interest and cooperation, and I'll leave that to evolve.
Thank you so, so much for your beautiful and really poetic presentation of your thoughts and ideas tonight, and relating that. I read, although I didn't hear it in the introduction, but it must have been in Calcutta that you worked with Mother Teresa, and I wondered if you would care to elaborate a little on your time together and what unfolded in your life from that.
Yeah,
had the good fortune to work with many, many people. Mother Teresa was in that first introduction in Calcutta at the Institute of Tropical Medicine. And being young and indefatigable and American, at the end of the workday, I would go out and this unknown Albanian nun was working right outside. So I started working with her and I remained quite close to her till she died.
Good evening, Dr. Cahill, and thank you so much for your beautiful, beautiful presentation. I was a physician to this community for quite a long time. And in the course of that role, I got to see some interesting diseases in folks that came from foreign countries. In my role here, I also integrated Ayurvedic medicine in practice. The community here was very interested in that. And I'm wondering what experiences you might have had in practicing medicine in various places, interacting with and how that might have gone with indigenous healers.
Sure. I worked with a lot of indigenous healers, and one of the things I at least learned was, for example, in southern Sudan I was working, and this was in the area of the Dinka and the Nuer, and tragically they're still killing each other 50 years later in the exact same town where I worked. But having said that, as I said in this talk, when you're young, you think you're very important, not only in refugee camps, but you think you have Western methods. I realized very quickly that the people trusted him. He had some ashes and some bones, and he had various other ways, but he was gonna stay there, I was gonna leave. And so with great humility, I said, why don't we work together while I'm here? And maybe I left a little impression behind, but I have worked not as rigorously as you people have worked in holistic medicine and the linkages between Western and Ayurvedic. So I think you'd be better able to answer that thing than I. My great difference was the change from being just a physician to running refugee camps. And it's a totally different thing. And one of the things I think that has to happen is medicine, and we had this discussion last evening, has to get over setting up their barriers and saying we're so important and everything, because in a refugee camp it simply doesn't work. And medical people are very often the most difficult ones to get to work as part of a team. So that's, you have to beat them into shape.
Thank you for painting a beautiful picture of humanitarian work. It's really inspiring to see someone of your magnitude come here and receive this award and give such a beautiful idea of the life you've lived. And I was wondering, with your experience in with humanitarian work, if healing is, as far as the medicine goes, Is it also creating, you know, agriculture and sustainable lives for those people who are, you know, displaced and in terrible situations?
Yeah, I would think that you'd be blind not to see the interrelations. So, I mean, obviously, and yet I didn't have some of the skills. I mean, these were big, complex jobs if you end up with big numbers of people in refugee camps. But you learn very quickly that everybody, including, you know, sustainable, I don't know why it flashes in my mind, but I was always impressed that in big refugee camps, the first thing, once they settle down for the first few days, you see, say, a mother putting pebbles out in front of her hut to mark out a sidewalk, or you see, I mentioned education as one of the things that is often missed completely in the implementation of programs in a refugee camp. But if you ask mothers and children, what's the most important thing they want? They want a tree to hide under. And you'd be blind if you didn't use that opportunity to teach them something about nutrition or how not to step on a landmine or things like that. So sustainable development, I think, has a very great role. I'm not, again, competent enough to know about how you incorporate it. My main function at times was in the immediate post-disaster crises, whether that was an earthquake or a conflict. And there are people who stay on beyond in the development phase, and it was just not what I did.
Good evening. My wife and I were two of your patients back around 1981. And of course, we were TM teachers, and you know, of course, the rumor mill would flow around about who actually could cure some of these things that we came back with. And of course, everyone, you have to go see Dr. Cahill, and particularly that you seem to have some special methods for testing and detecting when people were infected that weren't that commonly known at that time. And I remember I'd been tested and they didn't detect anything, but I knew something was wrong and you had some other technique. So my question is, how have you seen the evolution of the treatment of tropical diseases in these 30, 40 years in terms of the knowledge of the, let's say, of doctors throughout the United States and other countries and people coming back from these less developed areas?
It's been mostly a disaster. And the reason is economic. I have been a professor of tropical medicine and parasitic disease at NYU for almost 40 years. Every single person I've trained has gone into gastroenterology. And they call up and say, Kevin, you're crazy. We're getting $3,000 on the Upper East Side for a colonoscopy. We make do 3 in the morning, make more than you make in 2 weeks. And it's not that I had any particular technique. It's a longer, but very brief response to your question is, stool studies tend to be very inaccurate because parasites don't live in the stool, they live in the bowel wall. So if you just put a stool specimen, my wife used to say I could get diarrhea into any conversation after dinner, but anyway, now I'm getting into it now. But anyway, if you put a stool specimen into a container, it's not only inherently indirect, but you're putting it into a preservative that stops the very thing you'd like to see, and you'd like to see motility with what is called the trophozoite phase. So what I was taught in England, where I did my degree in tropical medicine, was to, if you had a sore throat, you'd open a patient's mouth and you'd look in their mouth, and here I'm doing the same thing, taking material directly off and doing a scraping. It's called a wet mount. Anyways, it wasn't my technique, it's the standard. But somebody asked today, couldn't somebody come and train with you? And I was thinking afterwards, as I was taking a rest this afternoon, that I think the very first job I had at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases was in, it goes back to herbs. The treatment for tapeworm in those years was a drug called male fern. And you'd give them male fern, and then you'd follow it with purgatives, and there'd be a container, literally this high. And my first job was to go through that container and find the head. And that's a very humbling thing. So you do that a couple of times, and you can't say somebody's just gonna come in and watch you do a procedure. It just doesn't work. So anyway.
Dr. Cahill, first of all, thank you very much for being here. This is really a very special evening for all of us. Dr. Manohar, who's our visiting Ayurveda doctor here, who's been with our community many years back and forth, and he's here right now. Yeah, very good, yes. He's a very good friend of me and my family. And anyway, he had a question for you. He asked me to ask it, so I hope I do justice, and he may have to add something. But his first point was, and I lost my page now here. So his first point was that there must be, you know, what we find with people who go to, say, India, who Western people who go to India, very often they come back with these bacterial infections that need treatment, that, you know, fester over time and all that. But aren't there bacteria everywhere? Don't we have a lot of bacteria in our food and water right here in the United States? And what is the difference? Why is it, am I doing justice to your question? So why is it that so many people coming back from, say, India or these other third world countries would have this problem and we don't face it here in the United States?
Well, there are two answers to that. One, it's probably not bacteria, it's probably parasites. And there's a difference between this and the biological classifications. Viral gastroenteritis might last for 7 days. Bacterial infections, if they do last for any length of time, they usually manifest with fever and things. But a good parasite doesn't want to kill you. It wants to live somewhere. And it can stay in you. And the English did studies 100 years ago showing you can carry them for 20 years. So they can last a long, long time. I was the head of the Board of Health of the city of New York for 12 years. And I can assure you, you don't have to leave the city of New York. You can go to a restaurant and the new cook from Bangladesh or Guatemala didn't wash his hands and serve sushi. So they do occur all around the world. They're obviously more common in areas where there isn't sanitation, and that was the whole advances in public health in this country. It wasn't probably good medicine. It was better water supplies and insect control. So they do occur. We sat next to each other at dinner tonight, so I wish you can ask the question, but anyway, we had a lovely night. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Dr. Marner, anything more? Okay, good. Well, thank you very
much. Thank
you.
Ma'am? I can hear you. I'll try to repeat the question. That you could possibly.
I could possibly envy.
Envy.
Mm-hmm.
Envy's not a good thing. That's probably in the Bible somewhere, but anyway. It's
but do you know of any other life you could have had that would have helped you become such a person?
No, I'm not saying I'm any better than anybody else, but I can't imagine another life. And somebody once asked me, how did you do this? And I said, the first thing was you had to marry the right person. So that I think was very essential.
Good evening, Dr. Cahill. I want to thank you again for really one of the most eloquent presentations I've heard here in my many years at the university. Your ability to express, you know, the horrors and yet the insights and the glories, if you will, of the people in those camps, I think is really extraordinary. And you commented that much depends on the mind's eye and how we perceive things. And I'm really fascinated by your ability to see within those contexts the best of humanity and these. And I wonder, were there prior experiences that you think cultivated that in you? Was that the time and repeated experiences in the camp, or how was it that you came to be able to perceive those out of such, you know, difficult situations?
I don't honestly know the answer. I came from a very large Irish Catholic family, and most of them think I was totally mad to go into this field. And most of my wife's family also thought I was totally mad to go into it. But I think if, you know, maybe Dr. Wallace and I were talking about Samuel Beckett tonight at dinner. I mean, maybe some aspects of Irish literature or Irish immigrant experience or something else. I never really felt, and I very truly say this, that I was doing anything noble. I was doing what I was put down on earth to do, and I did it the best I could.
My question is in regards to the programs that you have built for undergraduate programs in humanitarian efforts. It takes a special person to actually be a humanitarian, like you are, even a smaller level. So you'll have students of with a lot of heart value involved that are your students, and then some that don't have as much of that heart value involved in being a really good humanitarian. Can you talk about some of the results of the graduating classes and how that differences impact?
I run various programs for the trained humanitarian workers. The average age of our candidates is 38. So these are people coming from Doctors Without Borders, UN agencies. They're tough, it's a tough audience. They're working in the field and they come and that particular one is a residential 1 month course where I try to simulate humanitarian crises. It's a wonderful course. And we have over 3,000 graduates in that now, from 103. Then I run, I don't direct to myself, but we have courses on mental health and conflicts, on logistics. So we ran a lot of other courses for UN agencies. Just finished a course in Lebanon for people that OCHA, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian, brought out of Syria. So I run those things around. At the master's degree level, they're a younger group going for a master's degree. But the exciting one that I mentioned was this undergraduate major. And I have to say, and I think I told Mike, but it took 9 years to convince the New York State Education Board to give us the right to run a major, because we wanted to run it with various places overseas as well as on the Fordham campus. It was very essential, I thought. And that course is possibly the most popular course as a new major. And it was really, it just shows that young people don't want just, as I said to someone last night, become hedge fund operators. So there's a decency out there, and I think you just have to formulate a program that they can go through and graduate. That course is going to go into a 5-year program where they'll take an undergraduate major and then go right into a master's. So we'll see how it goes. Thank you very much, all.